We are so grateful for our guest preacher who will be with us this Sunday and next Sunday as well. C.B. Beale is a beloved colleague, a co-conspirator in our common struggle. C.B. will share reflections on the idea of preemptive radical inclusion as an entryway to meaningfully increase equity and justice among ourselves and in the world, a way to embody beloved community by our willingness to take seriously the idea that all of us means all of us. C.B. is a UU religious educator. And even though C.B. said not to mention any of these things because it's not the C.B. show, I want you to know that I am so proud that C.B. was the recipient of the 2019 of the Unitarian Universalist Association's Angus H. McLean Award for Excellence in Religious Education. Thank you, C.B., for gracing us with your presence, your wisdom. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you. It was an honor to get your email asking if I would perhaps consider joining you. I may have made a little squee noise. I would like to invite you to pause one more moment, take a breath, feel your seat in your seat, feel your feelings, notice them, give them names. I'm going to be here this week and next. And I'm very grateful for that. It can be said that Unitarian Universalists are particularly wordy people. And in fairness, look what I get to do for a living. We spend a lot of time talking about what we think is true. We do. We think about something, decide what's right, and take positions on things. And here's the thing. None of that was what Spork needed. As much as we UUs love to think, talk, argue, and search for truth and meaning, those activities do not build trust. They might build knowledge or awareness. They might build the kind of connection that comes from striving together with a common purpose. But talking about our ideas doesn't build trust. You know, it does. Talking about our lives and having our truth received and held dear. Trust is not primarily a cognitive brain-based experience. It's emotional. And if we are part, as I suggest we are, of a religious tradition that prides itself in and even sometimes prioritizes thinking, well, we have to work all the harder to build trust. Spork had no reason to trust the utensils that were in charge. None. Not simply because they ignored Spork, but because they did not know or care about Spork's life. They did not know or care to make space for Spork, what Spork was like or what they needed or what they cared about. So Spork had no feeling of connection, of care, of trust. In reconstructing the kitchen in our story, the other utensils spoke with Spork and learned about Spork's life, as well as the lives of others who are like Spork, and those who are different from both Spork and themselves. They started following people like Spork on social media and reading books, learning intentionally. They didn't just see a problem with drawers and build a new one that was just like the first one, only bigger. They connected with Spork in a way that meant that later on, they would not ignore Spork in another situation that was different. They would know Spork deeply and be in a mutually trusting relationship. And Spork could trust them because they had made themselves trustworthy. They restructured everything by changing their perspective, their behavior, and their environment. in congregational life, with discussions about funding and polity and the next social justice project, we spend a lot of time searching for what is right, what is best. And when we're striving to be right, we're living in our cognitive brain competing for rightness. And all too often it becomes a battle. And battles are not beloved community. Now, let me be clear. In the right circumstances, this competing for rightness, this battle, it is necessary. We battle systemic racial oppression. We battle patriarchal and homophobic laws about policing people's bodies. We battle police misconduct and murder, and we battle encroaching national fascism. And if arguing and battling is our most common way of interacting, it interferes in beloved community. Bearing witness is different. When we bear witness to people, we must consistently notice and then set aside our own thoughts and assumptions. Those things that don't yet make sense to us because we don't have the whole picture. We must recognize when what we're bearing witness to is so different from our own experience, we must take care not to dismiss it out of hand. When we bear witness, we prioritize the story someone else wishes to tell over the questions we have, where we would like their story to go, or how we mentally fill in the gaps as it goes along. We return our minds and our attention again and again simply to the story they tell us. And we set aside again and again our assumptions as they pop up. When we can still our minds and be present with someone, it's then that we're able to express meaningful empathy. We make space then to say, wow, that must have been so hard. Or, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry that happened. You did not deserve that. Or, that is amazing. I am so honored you told me that. Thank you. When we tell the stories of our lives, people have the opportunity to hold space for the unveiling of more of us. And I don't mean here just chit chat about our kids' recital or a ski trip or humble bragging about a promotion, although those certainly have important social places in interactions. But I mean the more meaningful stories, stories of our struggle for survival, curiosity about who we are and why we do what we do, our learning and our growing. When we share things that are deeply meaningful to us, our perspective and our experience. And then we find that the listener has received it and believed us. We will find that person trustworthy. The person who receives our experience makes themselves trustworthy. But we so often don't have this experience, do we? We all too often experience people trying to fix us or our situation. Or worse, they tell us that our experience is wrong. And when I'm telling the truth, it's all too often I, who try to fix things for others. When I was a kid growing up on a stony farm in the Adirondack Mountains of New York, I know, just mere adolescent mountains, nonetheless, I knew only about two genders, girl and boy. And I had two choices within girl. There was girl or failed girl, just as within boy, there was boy or failed boy. Where I lived, they called a failed girl a tomboy, and they called a failed boy a sissy or a fairy. People policed what a girl or a boy was. As I got older, I worked hard to find some words to describe my gender. I'm a tomboy farm girl. I'm a womanish type person. I'm a butch woman. I'm a masculine of center person. I tried out all sorts of things until finally I strung them all together and I would tell people, I'm a butch queer farm boy, tomboy farm girl, masculine of center, womanish type person. It was a lot of words. Well, it turns out my sexual orientation and my gender are both pretty queer. In the many decades since I was that child, we have developed better understanding and knowledge and language, and now there is a very simple word for my gender. I'm genderqueer. I'm non-binary, a gender that does not fall into the Western cultural idea of man and woman as opposites. I'm trans, meaning across from the gender that people expect me to have in a body that is called female. Not a man, not a woman, sort of both and also neither. My pronouns are they, them, and theirs. Now, there's a term called gaslighting that you might be familiar with. It means to manipulate someone into questioning their sanity. It comes from the play and movie of the same name. And in that movie, an abusive husband attempted to make his wife think that she was mentally unwell, to question her perceptions by, among other things, adjusting the lighting, a gas lamp, downward. And when she would say, "It's dark in here," he would say, "No, it's not." And it was repeated and repeated until she questioned her very ability to see. The goal of gaslighting is to get someone to disbelieve their own experience of reality and replace it with someone else's. This is different than discussing or persuading someone to think differently. It's manipulating someone into not trusting their own senses, their own thinking, their experience. This happens all too often in our personal and religious lives. People who are like Spork, people who do not experience their gender in some way that broader society tells them they're supposed to. These people are gaslit in our society every day. People say, "There's no such thing as trans. There's no such thing as non-binary." And the reasoning usually boils down to some version of, "I'm not non-binary and it doesn't make sense to me, so I don't believe." This is a more familiar experience than it may seem at first. It's an experience that's shared by those of us who are survivors of dysfunctional families and abuse, or of illnesses like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue that other people told us we didn't have. We have experienced being surrounded by people who told us we were wrong or broken. There are those of us who were told that we were bad and lazy when it turned out we were just neurodiverse, but nobody knew what it was back then. We too have experienced people tell us that our perceptions of our own experience is not valid, because these perceptions differ from someone else's. So, the story goes, it must be all in our head. Some version of, "I don't have that, I've never heard of it, I don't believe you." This is more broadly true for those of us who are survivors of and live with pervasive sexism, racism, homophobia, and ableism. "I've never seen that oppression like you described. It's not that bad. I don't believe you." And I must acknowledge that I have been on both sides of this equation, both the person whose reality is challenged by someone else who refuses to bear witness to my life, and the person who uses my own reality to judge others. When I come back next week, I will share some of the ways that I am my very own cautionary tale. But for right now, this. I come from about 400 years of Puritan New Englanders, from people with names like Harbot Grimscott. My family's like Puritans are us. Now, regardless of your personal family history, if you're you, you are deeply bound up in this history as well. I come from generations of people who, when someone dies, says, "Well, that's too bad. Got to get on with it. It's work to do." I come from people for whom grieving is private and internal and set aside as quickly as possible. And empathy, if even offered by the other Puritans, is shaken off. Feelings are meant to be something that flashes past, darting like a bird that never lands. In our own judgment, we are taught, is most likely right. We are raised to believe that we always know best. I grew up knowing only three feeling words: mad, sad, And what was the other one again? Oh yeah, mad. Now, personally, I think that this also means that since I come from this long line of people who, because we were never taught what it is to deeply experience what we're experiencing, our Puritan roots in our family cultures lead us to sometimes gaslight even ourselves. We were never helped to find words for our feelings, to fully experience grief or so many other big emotions. We were never helped to find words for our gender. So much of our whole culture prioritizes what we're supposed to be and who we should be and how we should be and even what we should feel over learning who we actually are. And if we weren't taught how to notice and honor and bear our own feelings, our own experiences of grief, gender, or otherwise, how could we possibly bear witness to others? How on earth can we express meaningful empathy? So many of us were never taught how to sit with other people's feelings, with their stories. Some of us, realizing that what our families had taught us about life was less helpful than they had thought, or that our coping mechanisms that had kept all those feelings at bay had accidentally turned into a drug or alcohol problem. So many of us joined support groups or recovery groups. Others of us joined covenant groups and small group ministry. We may have been flummoxed when we first entered those rooms and found that people just sat quietly listening while someone else talked. Why, sometimes they just went on and on. I started out being judgmental of other people taking up so much time talking about themselves. Oh my goodness, what an ego-driven thing, I thought. Wow, it sure is all about me in here. I had been taught that anything about me was too much. Others of us took to it like fish to water. Finally, I can speak and share without being interrupted or scolded or corrected. Over time, I realized that this is how humans grow, connect, how we develop trust and relationship, and that it's a core part of religious community, of beloved community. We learn to listen deeply, and we learn that other people will listen to us deeply. Will let us share at our own pace. Will believe what we say about our experience. Will care for us even when it's hard for us to care for ourselves. In beloved community, we learn that people will maintain our confidences and protect our autonomy and hold space for us to be different. And they'll join us in changing the spaces to make them more flexible and responsive. For some of us, this is the absolute opposite of how we grew up. We're learning to notice and tell our truth, and we learn to bear witness to others at the same time, sometimes quite late in life. In small group ministry and covenant groups, recovery or therapy groups, we learn to just listen, to suspend judgment, to notice and dismiss, or at least check out our assumptions. As it goes along, we find ourselves doing it elsewhere, bearing witness to people. We start noticing and resisting the impulse to be right or to tell someone what to do or how to fix it. Resisting the impulse to do or say anything that would move that feeling away from us. We bore witness to friends. We bore witness to colleagues. We sat and held space for people after tragedy. We learned how to be with someone's strong feelings without taking them in. To be empathetic and present without drowning in emotion. Next thing you know, we're bearing witness willy-nilly all over the place. In the supermarket a bit ago, I was doing a shopping trip, as one does, and there was a man in his mid-80s, about my dad's age, with that bent and gnarled but very stalwart posture. But he stood confused and determined in the soup aisle. There's a lot of soup in the soup aisle. I said, "Are you okay? Can I help?" He asked me if I knew where the mushroom soup was. He said, "Well, there's a few different brands. Did he know which one he wanted?" He told me he didn't really know. His wife had always cooked, and he didn't know what to get for her now that she'd died. I stood there for 10 minutes, and I listened to him talk about his wife and her cooking, and how confusing the grocery store is, and how he regretted never going with her to shop, the idea that had been his wife's job. He was wrong, he said. In the end, we identified the kind of soup she made, and I helped him choose two to try. But mushroom soup wasn't what he needed that day. He had to buy it, sure, but what he needed was for someone to see him, to bear witness to a way his life had completely changed, to how he was bereft and didn't know how he would continue moving forward. It was an honor to stand there with him in that aisle. Willy-nilly, I tell you. When we are present, simply present with someone, we open both ourselves and them up to possibilities. When we try not to control those possibilities or the outcome, but to just let it happen, what happens is miracles of connection, of trust. And the way it happens is nothing like what we expect. And it is always so much more beautiful. Amen. Blessed be. And may it be so because we make it so.